Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in Bank One, Texas versus Moody. The court is allotted 15 minutes for each side to present oral argument.
Mr. Michael Pegrin will present argument for petitioner. He has reserved 5 minutes of time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Pegrin. I'm a member of the firm of Hosey, Fresnel, Hosey & Pegrin in Galveston, Texas, and I represent the petitioner in this cause, who is a default defendant in the trial court below Bank One, formerly Deposit Insurance Bridge Bank. This case comes before this court upon the overruling by operation of law of petitioner's motion for new trial and to vacate judgment, or default judgment, and the affirmance thereof by the Court of Appeals. In affirming the overruling of petitioner's motion for new trial, the Court of Appeals failed to give weight to the findings of the trial court that petitioner's failure to file was caused by petitioner's negligence or lack of due diligence, and substituted its own finding that petitioner's failure was intentional, notwithstanding its concurrent finding that the failure to file an answer by the petitioner was the result of accident or mistake. The result was a misapplication or a misinterpretation of the rule of the Supreme Court in Craddock versus Sunshine Bus Lines Incorporated. On appeal, the court...
Counsel, before you proceed, is there any question here that the bank chose not to file an answer? This is an intentional act? Do you dispute that?
I don't dispute that, Your Honor.
Then, do we not have to exempt banks from the credit standard or change the standard?
No, Your Honor, we do not. The intent that was formed in this particular case was an intent that was formed on the mistaken belief that the bank had already performed all that would be necessary of it in order to absolve itself from responsibility under the writ of garnishment. The intent that was formed in this case is the exact same intent that was formed by Mr. Angelo in Angelo versus Champion Restaurant Equipment Company. In that case, Mr. Angelo intentionally did not file an answer after he was served with process in a suit on a debt and paid the amount that he believed was due on the debt. He believed in that case that payment of that amount would result in that case being dismissed and his liability being eliminated. He intended not to file an answer. In that case, the Supreme Court recognized that Mr. Angelo was under the mistaken belief that he did not have to file an answer, even though he then intended not to file an answer. The same intent exists in this case. The Court of Appeals found that the petitioner failed to file an answer due to mistake or accident, made that specific finding, and also made a specific finding that the petitioner had a meritorious defense, as did trial court below. That also found that the petitioner filed its motion at a time that the granting of which would not cause undue injury or delay to the plaintiff. However, the Court of Appeals affirmed the failure of the trial court to grant a new trial, stating that the accident or mistake notwithstanding, petitioner's failure to file the answer was intentional. Under the rule set forth in Craddock, the finding that petitioner's failure to file an answer was due to accident or mistake, coupled with the finding that there is a meritorious defense and that it was filed at a time the granting of which would not cause undue injury or delay, is determinative of petitioner's right to a new trial.
Counsel, I could not find much reference in either brief to legal mistakes or mistakes of law, yet there is case law that says a misunderstanding of the law does constitute sufficient excuse under Craddock.
There are cases that indicate that a mistake of the law would be sufficient excuse. Our position in this particular case, Your Honor, is that at the court, at the trial level, there was a finding that it was negligence, that this was a mistake, and that the Court of Appeals is correct in finding that the failure to file was due to accident or a mistake. We believe the Court of Appeals is wrong in then coming back and saying, notwithstanding the accident or mistake, The intentional filing, or failure to file an answer, is the determinative factor. That is not the determinative factor under Craddock. The issue in Craddock is test number one, cause. Was the failure to file an answer the result of an intentional, was it intentional, the result of conscious disregard, or was it the result of an accident or mistake? That is the causative determination to be made. The trial court made that causative determination. The Court of Appeals also made that causative determination. It determined that the failure to file was a result of accident or mistake. Notwithstanding that, they found that it was intentional and it was that intent, the fact that they acted intentionally, although mistakenly, that they supported their refusal to overrule the motion for new trial. It is our contention that that is inconsistent with its finding of accident or mistake, and is also improper under the rule of credit. It also ignores the finding of the trial court that the failure to file the answer by the petitioner was negligence or a lack of due diligence. That was a specific finding by the trial court. It was made from the bench. It's not a finding which was written and submitted by the trial court, but was an affirmative finding and ruling made by the court that the petitioner was negligent in failing to file an answer. It also made the affirmative filing that the petitioner had a meritorious defense. The trial court also made the affirmative filing that the equities lay with the granting of the motion for new trial unless, and that is unless the petitioner had the burden of establishing that it was not negligent in failing to file an answer.
This is where I have a problem in reading the Court of Appeals opinion. If you look at page 126 of Craddock, okay, the original opinion, the test is really contained in one sentence, and it is one test. Just like in EB, we set up global submission. But the way I read the Court of Appeals opinion, they're splitting the Craddock test into two parts. Am I correct, or am I misreading the opinion?
No, you are not misreading the opinion, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals misinterprets Craddock. It says Craddock is a four-test criteria, two of which are two separate tests, which are in fact one single test in Craddock. And that one single test in Craddock was the failure to file intentional or due to a conscious disregard, but rather was it due to accident or mistake. One single test. Court of Appeals says, no, it's two tests. Was it intentional? Two, was it due to accident or mistake? Three, was there a meritorious defense? Four, was it timely to cause undue injury or delay to the plaintiff? It finds, as did the court below, that we met their tests two, three, and four. But because on the mistaken belief that they had done all that was necessary, they intended not to file an answer, that is determinative. That is a misapplication of the first test of credit. Furthermore, as I pointed out, it substituted its own finding for that of the trial court below on the evidence. The trial court below found that the petitioner was negligent.
Counsel, you keep talking about finding. The pronouncements of the court are not formal findings of fact and conclusions of law.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I use the term finding not in the formal finding as under the rules of civil procedure. I use it it was a ruling by the court that was the basis for its instruction to both parties with respect to the determination of its decision on the motion for new trial. The critical issue to be determined by the trial court as to be briefed by the parties was not intent, was not meritorious defense, and was not timeliness. The issue that was critical to the trial court was the issue as whether or not the petitioner had the burden of establishing that it was not negligent in failing to file an answer. It wanted to know whether or not Craddock required lack of negligence or due diligence on the part of the petitioner before it could grant a new trial, and specifically directed us to brief that issue, stating that aside from that, the equities weighed in favor of the granting of a new trial. Those were briefed, and that is the basis for our position, and that is the basis for the court's not granting the motion for new trial at the trial level. The Court of Appeals improperly applied the test at the Court of Appeals level.
Any questions?
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Andrew J. Mitalko will present the argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Mitalko. I'm with the Galveston firm, Bearhurst and Adams. And I'm here today to pray to this court to affirm the findings of the Court of Appeal, the holding of the Court of Appeal in this case. First, I'd like to address a point which I believe Justice Gonzalez correctly points out. There were no findings in this case. This motion for a new trial was overruled by operation of law. That means that the Court of Appeal and this honorable court are you must presume that the findings were there to uphold the decision made by the trial court and the Court of Appeals. Moreover, the Court of Appeals in its opinion states that they found it was intentional failure to file. Straight out case. The bank president at the motion for new trial said, I didn't intend to file an answer. Now, the Court of Appeals in one sentence is on page 3 of the opinion I received from it, and I'm not sure on what page it's reported, states that while the intention may have been based on a belief that nothing further was required, the fact remains that the intention was not to file an answer. This is a very narrow issue that this court is faced with.
I would like to stop you right there because I have the same sentence underlined. It's on page 282.
Okay,
the intention was not to file an answer because they thought nothing else needed to be done. Is that not a legal mistake, a good faith mistake of law?
I don't believe it is a good faith mistake. It may be a mistake of fact, but I don't think it's a mistake of law. The bank president here received the writ, and he's received these writs before. He said so at the hearing. He's received these writs, and he's referred other matters to attorney. The bank here chose not to refer this matter to an attorney, and I'd cite the case to an old case called the Globe Leasing case, and it's not cited in my brief. It's 437. Southwest 2nd 43, and it was a very narrow point in there, and it said corporations must be represented by attorney, and if they don't, they do so at their own risk. Well, the bank here took it upon itself to represent itself, and it didn't file an answer, and he said he didn't intend to file an answer. I think that the key in the mistake cases, Your Honor, is that the party intended on filing an answer, but because of some happenstance, an answer doesn't get filed. The mistake is...
And
yes,
Texas
sir.
State Board of Pharmacy versus Martinez.
Yes, sir.
The defendant didn't think he misunderstood the law. He didn't think he had to file an answer. He didn't file an answer, and under Craddock, it was held that a legal mistake can satisfy the Craddock standards. Now, if the bank officer here did not believe he had to file an answer, why would that not fall under the same rule?
Well, I think the issue, Your Honor, is the court entitled to believe that the bank officer didn't intend that, or did the trial court make a finding that he just didn't believe the bank officer? The bank officer got there, he said that, I mean, this is in the record, he said somebody in his bank called the district clerk and got some advice. He didn't know who called who, where, no evidence of it, and I think the presumption is the trial court just didn't believe that. He was mistaken.
Well, the trial court disbelieved testimony on a credit hearing unless it's controverted directly?
Well, the only way to controvert this testimony, Your Honor, was by cross-examination. And the cross-examination, he asked him who spoke to who. He didn't know. He didn't do it. It wasn't personal knowledge. He didn't know. They didn't have any evidence of the bill. He didn't know what number they called. There is no other way of controverting it here.
But you're familiar with our decision in Strachbein versus Pruitt.
I am, Your Honor.
That the movement's representations are going to be taken as true unless there's some direct evidence to the contrary, and then that sets up a factual issue for the trial judge to resolve.
I understand that, Your Honor, and but the, what the Strickland case does not do is say how you have to controvert it. In this case, the way we controverted it was at the hearing, and it was through cross-examination of the witness. And what's interesting is that the affidavit involved here was the affidavit of Mr. Figlein, not of the bank president. And that was pointed out to the trial court, and he overruled that. And we contended that they hadn't met the plenary jurisdiction period because the affidavit wasn't made with someone's personal knowledge. It was made by Mr. Figlein. He said that he was familiar with the facts, and then he signed off on it.
Figlein, Mr. Figlein said identical to Angelo, and just like in Angelo, we accepted and granted the relief based on a mistaken belief. We should do so here too. What is your response to that?
I don't believe that the Angelo case is controlling here. I believe that the First National Bank of Bryan versus Peterson is controlling here. And in that case, the bank did exactly what the bank did here.
How is this different from Angelo, which is one of our Supreme Court cases? That's the question.
I believe that the difference from Angelo is that in that case, the party basically paid everything he was owed. It's with my understanding of the facts in that case.
Is there any dispute here that the bank sent over to the district court all the money subject to garnishment?
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
What's the nature of that dispute?
In the defense exhibits that they presented, and the amounts here are not material to the principles involved.
The amount was $38 and some odd cents.
Exactly. The amount that was in the accounts on the day the writ was received was higher than the amount they sent. They allowed the guy to cash a check, and they allowed the bank to offset some teller machine charges where the guy was going in and finding out how much he had in his account. Now, the amounts here are obviously not material, but the principle is.
What are the amounts? They remitted something like $40?
$41.32.
That's right.
And how much do you claim that they didn't remit because of?
They didn't remit, I guess it's approximately $14. But the principle, it's not the amount here that really should make a difference. It's the principle. If a bank allowed to say, oh, they got $1 million judgment, we're going to let them take out $999,000 and give the garnishor $1,000, it's the principle involved. They said their policy was they put a hold on the account, and they didn't, and in fact, put a hold on the account. Or if they put a hold, it didn't apply to the money from a teller machine.
Counsel, in Craddock, it stated quite clearly that the question is controlled by principles of equity. Now, if principle is involved, and we're talking about equity, here we have a questioned amount of $14 at most, yet we have a default judgment for $98,000. And if we're talking about principle and equity, how do you reconcile those?
I believe that what Craddock says, Your Honor, my interpretation is said that they must look at principles of equity, but I don't believe equity is the only standard by which cases are measured. We are courts of law, not only courts of equity. And the law says that you're commanded to file an answer, and they didn't file an answer. Is it a harsh remedy? Absolutely. I don't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you have said yourself that this particular bank had received citations of this sort before, and they contacted their lawyers and they filed answers. Here, according to what we have before us, the total amount that they were able to determine in the bank was spread among three accounts and amounted in total $41.32. Now, you can't pick up the telephone and call your lawyer for that small an amount. And if they had dealt with lawyers before, they'd dealt with this type of proceeding before, and the lawyer had advised them on what they needed to do, and they did that, on a mistaken belief that that was all they were required to do. They did not file an answer because they believed that if they held whatever was on deposit pursuant to this proceeding, that was all they were required to do. Now, the fact you have an intentional act based on a mistaken belief, an uncontroverted mistaken belief apparently, and you're saying that does not meet the test of credit?
I believe, first of all, Justice Gamage, I don't believe that there was any testimony that they had gotten advice from their attorney to send a check. I'm sure that if they had gotten advice, you would have said send an answer or at least a cover letter.
Apparently they didn't even talk to their lawyer in this particular case.
That's correct.
Was one of their mistakes.
Absolutely.
One mistaken belief, but wasn't even necessary considering the amount they had.
Well, I guess...
I'm not sure what the basis for their attorney's billing is. Assuming it's $200 an hour, and they're going to get billed for a minimum of 15 minutes, they couldn't have called their lawyer for $41.32.
I don't disagree with that. Lawyers charge a fair amount of money to file answers on behalf of parties, but that's a cost of doing business. And the facts are, is the court going to set up a test that says if the amount of money is less than $50, then we're going to be immaterial?
The test is mistake.
But
and
here
the mistake is to be considered in the context, counsel, the surrounding circumstances.
I understand the equity. I don't consider it the equity, but I understand the harshness of the rule here. And this is maybe one of the harshest applications of this rule. There is no question that the bank had somewhere between $27 and $40 in the account, and the judgment was for $83,000 in interest is run. It is a very harsh remedy. And I've been grappling with this decision since I got notification from the court that writ was granted. And I mentioned it to one of the district judges down in Galveston, and he said, well, you ask the Supreme Court, whose writs are we going to allow people to ignore? Is it just going to be district court writs, or are we going to allow people to ignore the appellate court writ, or even this honorable court's writ? If they mistakenly believe that they have no liability or their liability is voluminous. And it's a hard point to grapple with. I agree that the consequences in this case are harsh, but the law can be harsh sometimes. And the law, we're a court of law, and people are commanded to file answers. And I don't believe that it was equitable for the bank on their behalf to disregard the rights that the writ commanded them to do. And the writ also said, do not send any money, which is exactly what they do. And so they disregarded that part.
Aren't you talking
about a default judgment as opposed to a new trial on the merits? This doesn't relate to the merits.
Well, but the new trial portion of the case, Your Honor, is strictly, did they intend not to file an answer? And I think the record was clear that they did not intend to file an answer, and he said that, and the Court of Appeals upheld that, and now this court is grappling with the issue of, if his intent is based on mistaken belief, if that's true, does that excuse it? I mean, that's the narrow issue here.
Counsel, Rule 1 says, of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, the objective of these rules is to obtain a just, fair, equitable, and impartial adjudication of the rights of the parties. Was that done here?
Hard to say, Your Honor. I believe that it was a harsh consequence, and I consequence allowed by the rules, and so I can't really comment whether that is that just or equitable if the rule allows you to take an action which is taken, and then a harsh result comes about from it. I'd also like to at least mention the other pending case before this court, the Holt case. And that's another default case, and my understanding of that case is that they basically sued a subsidiary of the parent. It was the wrong party type defense. And Holt came in and argued, well, we didn't have anything to do with this. They should have sued our subsidiary or some other affiliated corporation. And then they got presumed findings, and we didn't get our day in court, which is, I'd like to at least distinguish that case, because I think there is no question here that the bank was the right party. And Holt, I think it deals with the plaintiff sued somebody other than was responsible, and the person they sued didn't file an answer, and a default judgment laid. I'd at least like to distinguish that by, this is not a wrong party case. And in that case, they got a judgment for $150,000, which is also a very harsh remedy.
Counsel, the opinion says that the other requisites of Craddock were satisfied. Is that correct?
That is what the opinion indicates.
How much attorney's fees did the bank offer? Or did the bank offer to tender attorney's fees?
The bank said that they were prepared to go to trial and to compensate us. We never got as far as how much attorney's fees were, but there's no question that they did make that offer. And I do take issue with the fact that all of the requirements of Craddock were met, because I don't believe they actually made a meritorious defense. The writ of garnishment directs you to do three things. One, how much money are you indebted? Two, what effects do you have? And three, who else do you know has money of this person? Now, and the bank president got up there and said he didn't have any personal knowledge, but I mean, common sense tells you that every bank has a financial statement, and it tells you where these people have money, and that's part of the writ of garnishment rule. It tries to direct you to be able to satisfy a judgment you have. Now, there was no objection made on that question saying, well, that's a privacy issue or you know, there's some privity or any kind of privacy issue involved, and so I think they waived that part. But the rule clearly says, tell us who else has the money of this person so we can satisfy ourselves. They clearly didn't do that. And I argued this to the Court of Appeals. They apparently ignored it because they said he met the defense rule too. But I'd at least like to raise that for this court, that is a requirement in the rule, which they did not do anything of. And he said they didn't even make a search of it. So I do think there were some technical problems with the meritorious defense argument. But the clear fact that they didn't have...
You know they had a financial statement?
No, I don't know that.
For these $41 accounts?
I don't know they had a financial statement. I do know they had three accounts with a total of $40 or something to that fact. But I don't know for a fact that he had a financial statement. But I think that they could have made some inquiry into who, some answer to that part of the test should have been made. I'd also like to address the fact that Craddock has been in the law for 51 years. There have been very few cases construing it. It's a workable standard. Unlike discovery issues that come up to this court constantly, there are very few cases that come up on default judgments. It's a workable standard, it's predictable, and it leads to judicial economy. All this bank president had to get up there and say is, I made a mistake, and you know we intended. He didn't say that. I can't explain why he didn't say this, but he got up there and said, we didn't intend to file an answer, we sent a check, and that's all we thought we had to do. He obviously didn't read the writ, which said, don't send a check to anybody, and the rule is harsh, and sometimes law is harsh, but Bank One is a big institution, and it does business like everyone else in this state, and they should be bound by the laws like everyone else in this state. I understand that this court is faced with a harsh consequence, and I wish you firm the case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Please, the court, just a couple matters in rebuttal. Counsel believes that this case should be controlled by the same principles as exist in First National Bank of Bryan versus Peterson, stating that the facts of First National Bank of Bryan are exactly the same as the facts in this case. Excuse me. Stating that the facts of First National Bank of Bryan are exactly the same as the facts in this case. Point out to the court that is not the case. The Court of Appeals in First National Bank of Bryan specifically stated and found that the bank officers in that case did nothing but freeze the accounts and stated all they had to do was something and a new trial would have been granted. But they did nothing. In this case, the bank froze the accounts. It did take action. It relied upon the mistaken belief that the information it secured from the district court would be sufficient to absolve it from further liability under the writ of garnishment. It followed that action and took it. It was mistaken. Counsel states that all that would have been necessary at the trial level would have been for the president of the bank to have stood up and said, I made a mistake. And he didn't say that, he says. He did say that. He, on direct examination, he said, did you intend after this not to file an answer? Yes. On redirect, he was asked whether or not that intent was formed on the basis that he thought that he had done everything that he was required to do. And he said, yes, that's correct. His intent was formed on a mistaken belief. And it is that mistaken belief that is the key element in the case of Craddock.
But if you prevail on that argument, isn't that going to be the argument every time in every default judgment? Parties are going to argue we intended not to file an answer or comply with the law, and it was our mistake. So therefore, the Craddock standards are going to be reduced to nothing.
No, sir, I don't believe that that's the case. I believe that if that's all anybody has to rely upon, that that's what's going to be stated. But Craddock already recognizes that an intentional action that is the result of an action or mistake is all that is necessary as a matter of law, with the other requirements having been met, for a new trial to be granted and a default judgment vacated. That is a long-standing principle. That principle was met in this case. The failure to file an answer was the direct result of an accident or mistake, and we believe that the Court of Appeals judgment should be reversed, that the cause should be remanded to the trial court for a new trial and the default judgment vacated. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.
Your Honor, if you could rise.